Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hi, this is Celia Cutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Build it, they will come. And that's exactly what a couple of women did 70 years ago. We'll hear a lot more about that when I speak with Dr. Tim Ryan, the president of the Culinary Institute of America, today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And indeed, build it, they will come. Who knew? The Culinary Institute of America has grown over the years to become the most prestigious food service and culinary education center in, I would say, probably the world, but we'll hear from the voice that will tell us that. I am very honored and pleased to have Dr. Tim Ryan, the president of the Culinary Institute, here with us today to tell us all about that history, interesting history, yes, a couple of women, and the growth and expansion of and changes that it has undergone through the years. Dr. Ryan is the fifth president of the CIA. In fact, he's the first president to have graduated from the CIA. He graduated in 77 and then went on to get his doctorate in education at the University of Pennsylvania. It was not long ago when Nation's Restaurant News listed him as one of the 50 most powerful people in food, Daily Meal and Nation's Restaurant News. What Nation's Restaurant News says is that Tim Ryan is not only transforming the next generation of chefs and how they're educated, but also influencing nearly every aspect of the restaurant industry. And certainly reading his bio, one is confirmed of that statement. And you only have to look at the roster of graduates, students and graduates from the CIA to know that doesn't read like a list of who's who in food service. It is the who's who of food service in America. Dr. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Linda, it's great to be here. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Well, you know,
somebody with the name of Tim Ryan has to say that.
I figured it was only right that I had an Irish name on the show. We are, just for our listeners, many of whom will probably listen next week or tomorrow, we are recording this on St. Patrick's Day. So, indeed, happy St. Patty's Day.
Absolutely. And I have to talk to you every day because with that introduction, I feel so great now. Thank you.
Well, you know, it's hard to weed out what to say about you, because there's so many accolades written, and I just, you know, I figured I would start with a little bit, and we will continue to talk about it. Now, you indeed were a graduate of the Culinary Institute, and only the fifth president in 70 years. That's, I think, really saying something about the institution, you know, keeping continuity in its education. But before we talk about your background there, tell us a little bit about the history of the CIA and how it got started. With a name like Tim Ryan and the CIA, I mean, someone looked at me askance and said, what are you doing government today? But no, indeed, we're talking culinary history.
Exactly. And in fact, just as a little point of history, there is another CIA that some people are familiar with, the Central Intelligence Agency. but my CIA, the Culinary Institute of America, predates them. They were originally the OSS. That's, in fact, the organization mm-hmm. that Julia and Paul Child worked for and took them all around the world. They didn't become the Central Intelligence Agency until 1947. Of course, the Culinary Institute of America started in 1946. Therefore, we are the first.
Couldn't you trademark that so they couldn't have taken it?
Well, we've tried, but we have, over the years, friendly relationships with that other CIA. But anyhow, about the history of the school, and you touched on it, I think, very well at the top of the program. We were founded by two women, and this happened in 1946. So, of course, the Second World War had just ended. The GI Bill had been passed, one of the greatest pieces of legislature in American history, a transformative act even to this day. So millions of veterans were returning from overseas, and the two women were really inspired by a group of local restaurateurs in New Haven, Connecticut, the New Haven Restaurant Association. And it was the restaurateurs that came up with the idea that became the CIA. But they were busy running restaurants, so they knew that they couldn't launch this effort. And so they went to the first of our two founders, a woman by the name of Frances Roth, an extraordinary individual, the first female admitted to the Bar Association in the state of Connecticut. She was born and raised in New Haven. She studied at NYU's law school. She was a suffragette. And just a dynamo. And the restaurateurs knew her because she was the assistant district attorney in New Haven at the time, and they knew she was just a dynamo. So they talked her into launching this effort, and she quickly brought on her good friend, Catherine Angel. And Mrs. Angel was the wife of the president of Yale University. And so our first real campus was within the campus of Yale. They lent us buildings and 14 acres and bootstrapped the Culinary Institute of America. So our origins are at Yale and led by these two dynamic women. Over the school, blossomed right away and continued to grow to gain international prominence. And by the late 60s, we were busting at the seams and landlocked in our little patch of land down there on the Yale campus, had no room to grow because on one side was the School of Theology and the other side was the School of Forestry. So we commenced a nationwide search to find a new campus that would accommodate our growth and aspirations, and found a magnificent facility here in Hyde Park, New York, the home of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that was a Jesuit seminary. And at one time, there were hundreds and hundreds of young seminarians studying here. It's a magnificent, the main building, a magnificent building right on the banks of the Hudson River. But by the summer of love, the attendance had dwindled down to really a handful. And so the Jesuits, who were brilliant scholars but not great marketers, sent out a film to Catholic schools throughout the country that was black and white, reel-to-reel, showing seminarians scrubbing floors and working in the fields. And across the screen came the Jesuit vows, chastity, poverty, obedience. Somehow those were not resonant themes.
Not a big sell.
In the summer of love. And that was to the CIA's advantage. So we were able to acquire this property for 80 acres on the Hudson River for really a song. And moved here then in 1972.
I was going to ask you how they got the funding for that, because if you haven't visited, it's just worth the drive. A short hour and 45 minutes or 2 hours north
right.
of New York City. Beautiful, beautiful area. And obviously it's grown since since it first started. But I was wondering about that, where the funding came from that. Well, now you explained it all. And so in 1972, how many students were there approximately?
Well, I'll tell you just a little bit more about the funding. So what happened was Yale, though they had given us the property in New Haven, they wrote us a check for $1 million to help us out and said, you know, here, because they would get back that property, which obviously had increased in value. If anybody ever wants to visit it and you're in New Haven, it's on Prospect Street. It's now the Global Fellows Institute of Yale University. They gave us $1 million, and lo and behold, we paid the Jesuits $1 million for this property. Now, we've invested hundreds of millions since then.
Right.
But the campus is wonderful now and is 200 acres. But that's how it all started out. Back in 1972, the number of students, it would probably have been about 800, somewhere around there.
I know that the number of 1,000 was thrown around talking about how the women, the two, Catherine and Frances, you know, how it grew and they expanded so much they needed a, you know, bigger space. But that sounds about right, 800
right.
Students, yeah.
And
today, what is your enrollment today?
We have over 3,000.
On just that campus?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, of course, we have campuses in the Napa Valley, in San Antonio, Texas, and in Singapore.
Well, and you were quite responsible for the expansion of the two newest ones in San Antonio and Singapore. And I want to get to that. We'll get to that in just a minute, because what I want to talk about is before the San Antonio and the Singapore campus came about, or in Napa Valley for that matter, a lot of changes came about in the curriculum and offerings at the school. And when did the degree program become instituted?
The original CIA was a short program. This was back in Hyde Park, and that offered a certificate. And when we moved to Hyde Park, that's when we started to grant associate's degrees. And so we were the first culinary school in the world. First of all, we were the first, you know, school of its kind in the world. And people don't really know that, and we were certainly the first to offer a degree. We started to offer bachelor's degrees in 1993.
Right, okay.
And so that's a long time ago. And,
right.
You know, in the near future, we'll begin offering master's degrees.
Mm-hmm. That was one of my other questions. I figured it was a natural to follow, but
absolutely,
yeah. But
no.
certainly very interesting that one can go to what has been for a long time considered, you know, vocational training, but here you get an education, a full education, and you get you know, a bachelor's degree as well. Excellent. So let's talk about the expansion to these other locations. Let me back up, and you attended and graduated in 1977. What was the school like then compared to what you would see today? In terms of you know, education, course offerings, things like that.
Right. Well, you know, that's a great question, and just to put it into context, you know, historically, I mean, 1977 is a galaxy apart in terms of the culinary development in the United States from where we are today. And so the curriculum kind of reflected that. I mean, there were no star chefs yet. You know, I was arguably amongst the first generation that started to own their own restaurants and get, you know, prominence and so on. But back in the 70s, you know, chefs were... The federal government considered us and classified us as domestics. You know, it wasn't a super highly regarded position. The best chefs were from France. And so many of us were inspired by Paul Bocuse, who and his contemporaries. But particularly Paul, he's kind of like the Elvis Presley of chefs. you know, Elvis Presley is the big bang of rock and roll, and Paul Bocuse represents the big bang of chefs. You know, the world changes for all chefs following Paul Bocuse. But in terms of the curriculum, you know, again, it was reflective of the day, and things have just changed so much. So it was a lot of French food, because if you wanted to be a serious chef, you wanted to be, you know, really, really great, you had to cook French cuisine. And the ingredients were pretty basic. So if you reflect back, you're too young to remember this, Linda, but and probably you know, many of your listeners are too young. But here at the CIA, if a faculty member referred to mushrooms in the 1970s, he was, because there were very few female faculty members, he was undoubtedly using the plural form of white button mushrooms, because mm-hmm. that's all that was available.
Mm-hmm.
Fresh herbs, the only thing that was available was you had a choice of curly parsley and flat leaf parsley. If you talked about peppers, that was for sure the plural form of green bell peppers, because nothing else was available in the U.S. markets. And if you contrast just herbs, mushrooms, and peppers then with today, and you know, what we have available, and then think about how that changes education and how much more complicated education becomes. And then you layer things on top of that, like all the different global flavors. When I graduated from the CIA, we got a smattering of Chinese, and we learned about Austrian and Swiss and, you know, those kinds of things. But, I mean, compared to today and what the expectations are in terms of knowledge, you know, again, we're worlds apart.
Well, it's amazing that you then went on to, you know, to be in the Culinary Olympics and one of the winners of the and a certified master chef and one of the winners of those international competitions with what you're describing. And yes, I do remember quite well the foods at that time, and it was difficult.
Well, you're a historian. So that's why.
And trying to get any kind of so-called exotic, which today is standard supermarket shelf food,
right,
you know, ingredients to make an international dish was practically impossible. So I imagine that the teaching was, you know, reflected that, as you say.
That said, the CIA was the best in the world at the time. It was just reflective of that era.
Right. Well, in fact, you mentioned Paul Bocuse was the, you know, the rock star of the culinary world. And I have a quote that I think probably came from the CIA site that he said at one of the ceremonies where he was there, that the first time he visited, he said, "The first time I visited, I knew I had found a school that teaches the traditions of the world's cuisines. It's the best culinary school in the world." And in fact, he went on to enroll his son, did he not?
That's right. Jerome, Paul's son, who's a good friend and is one of the leaders of the whole American Bocuse d'Or effort with Thomas Keller and Daniel Ballou, is a graduate of the CIA. Great guy.
You know, so many people who've been influential in the culinary world have sung the praises of the CIA. Craig Claiborne, the New York Times food writer and influencer, likened it to so many top training institutions, you know, that West Point for military, the Juilliard for music, and the CIA for food, right?
Right.
And Julia Child, what did she call it? She called it the Harvard of culinary schools. And that, yep. So that was quite a compliment to, you know, to an institution. Well,
all good friends and great people.
That's great. And certainly, your influence over the—you became president in 2001?
2001, mm-hmm. Yeah, but I've been here now. After graduation, I was out in the restaurant industry, but now I've been—and then I came back to open the American Bounty Restaurant, which was kind of a breakthrough effort here, and that was in the 1982 we started that project. Which, again, it's kind of hard for our students today to think about that. But back in 1982, when we announced that we were going to open an American restaurant, that was met with some measure of ridicule in the American food service industry. Like, what are you going to serve, hamburgers and hot dogs? And, so we were really at the first wave and helping to lead what became the American cuisine movement. along with a bunch of our alumni like Larry Forgione and Jasper White up in New England, Dean Faring down in Texas, Bradley Ogden out in California, and many, many more. But we've come a long way since then in terms of the development of American cuisine. It's taken for granted today. But back then, you know, we really had to think about it and convince people that we did have our own native indigenous cuisine.
Right. And you really are a champion, the one, you know, known for having championed American cuisine. And I think that's incredible, and that's excellent. Often on this show.
Linda, you mentioned the Culinary Olympics, which happens, as you know, every 4 years in conjunction with the Sporting Olympics. National teams come from all over the world to compete against each other. And I was the captain of the team in 1988. Boy, that sounds like a long time ago. And we won the world championship. So part of the Olympics is that you bring dishes, and you cook things that are representative of your national cuisine. And so that was a huge breakthrough for American cuisine, that, you know, all these German and Austrian and Japanese and Indian and, you know, judges from all over the world said, hey, the American team is the best. They're the world champs. So that really got us a lot of notice for sure back then.
A feather in your talk.
Right.
You know, you mentioned the faculty and what they were faced with, and not having, there were no women on the faculty
right.
at that time.
Yeah.
Today, what's the number in terms of faculty and the total faculty?
Oh, I don't know the total number, but it's probably about 50-50, which is representative of our student body. So, you know, back when I was a student at the CIA, I don't know, probably it was 8% of the student body, you know, was probably women.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my classmates who were women, by the way, ended up to be just fabulous. Like two of my classmates I literally went to the school with, one was Susan Feniger. you know, of Two Hot Tamales
right.
fame, and the other was Sarah Moulton, who then went on to work with Julia Child, and of course went right. to Gourmet Magazine, and so on. So we were all in the CIA together, but there were very few women, about 8% of the total student body. Today, it's 50% women here at the Institute.
And what's the total? How many people there? How many people work there? In other words, what is the total faculty?
Oh, faculty members.
With about, I mean, I didn't mean to throw
200,
you.
200.
Wow, yeah. Well, I figure with 3,000 students, you've got to have, you know, it's got to be a lot of people. And, of course, when I ask you these questions, I keep thinking of Hyde Park. But I'm sure your brain is thinking, which campus, where? What are we talking about? The entire institution, you know, which comprises all of them. Let's get back to that about opening. So the institution spread out to Greystone in California first, and now, of course, San Antonio and Singapore. That must be present a little bit of a challenge to run all these different campuses. What are some of the biggest challenges in trying to keep everything at the top of its game?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, the reason why we have four campuses, and it's important to underscore, I think, that the CIA, Culinary Institute of America, were private, not-for-profit institution. There are no owners. There's no shareholders. We were set up by the restaurant industry for the benefit of the restaurant industry and for our students. So if we have anything left over at the end of the year, it gets reinvested in the school and in student scholarships. And so, therefore, as we have other campuses, we've done that for strategic purposes. So back in the early 90s, we went to California because, I mean, it was clear by then, and it had already been happening for a decade, that, you know, San Francisco was such an influential, and the Bay Area, you know, so influential in the food scene that we really wanted to have a presence there.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw more and more of our students being attracted to the wine components of the industry. So Napa Valley was a very, very logical and strategic place for us to be. And, of course, that's more than we've had that campus open now for more than 20 years and are undergoing a major expansion out there right now. So that's been a wonderful fit. San Antonio, which was funded completely and endowed by a single billionaire.
Wow.
great guy by the name of Kit Goldsberry, who made his fortune on one product. He popularized Pace Picante salsa. And he's a native San Antonian. He made his money in the food world, and he wanted to give back to San Antonio. And so Kit came and said, "Geez, Tim, I want to build a canvas for the CIA and so on, and in San Antonio." And I told him no for about 4 years because we weren't really, you know, we're not a for-profit, so we weren't interested in expansion and all that. But the more I got to know Kit, we started to talk about the strategic benefits and what a bigger vision was. And we called that El Sueño, the dream. And so it was in recognition, the creation of the San Antonio campus was in recognition of the fact that the restaurants and food service operations of America are largely populated, particularly in the back of the house, by people of Latino origin.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, because of socioeconomic issues, they don't rise through the ranks of the industry at commensurate levels to leadership and ownership positions. And so we said, you know, with Kit's support, if we build a campus and provide endowed scholarships, we'll be able to change that in the future. The second part of that El Sueño initiative, the strategic initiative, the dream, was that Latino foods, particularly Mexican food, have been viewed for so long as cheap, not very good foods in America. And, you know, there's a whole wealth of diverse tastes and flavors and great quality that is not really being represented. So we wanted to see if we could change that, like the CIA helped to advance American cuisine forward. And so those are the two components of the mission and the strategic reason why we're in San Antonio. And then Singapore came about because of the importance of Asia. And we have a lot of students that come to us from all over Asia. And the Singaporean government came to us, and so they completely built the campus and endowed that for us. They underwrite all the activities there, and it's a great home base for us with a foothold in Asia. So that's the strategic importance of Singapore. And in terms of running them all, I mean, you know, just like running anything, you have to have great people. And so I'm blessed with great team. You know, I'm the president, but it's not just me. There's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people that contribute to the CIA effort, and we have wonderful leaders. We've got great managing directors in all our campuses, and so that's how it all works.
Well, certainly you're a...
I get to talk on the radio, and they do all the work.
That's right. Well, and obviously somebody has to be the deal maker, so you know, we got to have someone there at the top. I want to find out a little bit more about some of these new curriculum changes that have taken place, but
right.
We have to take a short break, so just hang in there, and we'll be back after a short break.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
Okay, we are back, and I'm talking with Dr. Tim Ryan, the president of the Culinary Institute of America. And, Tim, we were... is it okay I call you Tim?
Dr. Oh, absolutely.
Ryan. Dr. Ryan. No, I mean, I know it's sort of like, you know, once someone becomes a chef, you know, can I call him by his first name, or do I have to call him chef? you know, it's interesting because you were talking about the... how far the prestige of being a chef and restaurateur has come since the early days. And in fact, you know, back in the day, one didn't even know who was cooking in the kitchen. One didn't even know the name of the chef. You knew the restaurateur. You know, he stood at the door and welcomed everybody coming in. But it wasn't until really, I guess, the late 80s, that the chefs started coming out from behind the stove, you know, and being introduced as front and center. Well, and then by and by, the Culinary Institute of America made a lot of changes in the curriculum as well. Obviously, as you said, even just going out to Napa Valley or you championing the American cuisine, reflecting the change in society, reflecting the change of what people wanted. And today, the Institute offers a focus also on science and sustainability, new topics, food ethics. Tell me about some of those partnerships and some of those programs.
Well, we have quite a few high-profile partners, including Harvard. We've got a lot of initiatives with Harvard, and specifically we work with the Harvard School of Public Health. And all our efforts, and also Harvard Medical School. And these are formal partnership arrangements. We have, a host of different conferences. We do joint research, and it's really been a great partnership. We do conferences, I mentioned, many are for the food service industry, but also for the medical community. So we have a major conferences called Healthy Kitchens, Healthy Lives that attracts, 500 MDs at a time, is the fastest selling continuing medical education course in Harvard history. And, a typical keynote speaker would be the Surgeon General of the United States. So the initiatives and the partnership with Harvard are important. In agriculture, we work oftentimes with UC Davis out in California. We have a joint degree program with Cornell Hotel School, which is fabulous, and a very close partnership with Cornell. And we have another partnership with MIT. And their famous media labs, and we do a lot with them because technology is important. And we have a great conference that we do with MIT called Rethink Food, and it's about the intersection of food, technology, the behavioral sciences, and innovation. And it's just fascinating. And the keynote speaker this year was the legendary Nicholas Negroponte. Who authored one of the most prescient books of all time, which is called Being Digital, which foretold the digital future years in advance. So those are great partnerships that we have, and we're proud of them. You know, I mentioned MIT because you talk about the evolution of our curriculum and all these new courses, and people sometimes still say, well, culinary arts, culinary school, we're a college, but, isn't that kind of a trade? And, well, that's how schools like MIT started. You know, MIT is a land-grant institution, which meant that it was created after the Second World War to train mechanics and engineers.
Mm-hmm.
These were people who had wrenches in their hands, who had oil on their fingers. The same is true with business schools. First business school in the world. I'm an alumnus of the University of Pennsylvania, as you mentioned, Wharton School of Business.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Wharton was an iron smelter. Business people were looked upon as having dirty fingers. And so there's real parallels to the culinary profession there. We're just earlier on in our evolution. And these are things that I studied and looked at and wrote about in my doctoral dissertation. As professions evolve, two things are required for true professions: increasingly higher levels of education, and then specialization.
Mm-hmm.
And so the CIA is pursuing those paths. So nowadays, where I was a student at school, there was one program. Everybody took the same thing, exactly the same classes. Now we've introduced, scores of electives to fit the growing body of knowledge and the career opportunities of our students. And we have all kinds of concentrations. If a student wants to come to the CIA and study farm-to-table cooking, and work on our farm in California and operate, you know, use all those products in our conservatory restaurant, all of which is led by legendary chef Larry Forgione.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to study Latin cuisines, you can go to our San Antonio campus and specialize on that. If you want to specialize in Asian cuisines, you can go to our Singapore campus and specialize in that. If you want to study Italian cuisines, we have a center for Italian food and wine here, but we're also going to open a castle in Puglia next January.
I'm there.
Yeah.
I'm going. That's it.
If you want to study wine, you can study wine in our facility in Napa Valley. What better place? If you want to focus on science, we have our laboratories and kitchens here. If you want to study food studies, if you want to be an entrepreneur, we have a whole program on entrepreneurs. So for a lot of people, they're like, wow, geez, what's going on? But it fits into the context of how professions develop, and that's really the strategy that we're pursuing. It's a well-worn path. Many other institutions and professions have been down it. It's just new for the culinary profession. Right.
Well, I think that's where our society today in general is going, as you mentioned, that you know, the specialization going, you know, getting an education, then going back to, you know, maybe getting your education first and then going into, you know, a trade school. Like a trade school, an educated trade school, but I think that's what society needs. We need, you know, good people who know how to do things very well, and and certainly CIA knows how to do it.
And CIA, you know, at CIA, we're not only providing those technical skills, that technical skills and knowledge base, which is critical and vital, but also business management and leadership courses, and some liberal arts. We want to have people with, you know, a broad perspective that are part of, you know, educated society,
right,
that know something about literature and language and history and all those kind of things. That makes for a well-rounded, fully developed person.
Well, it's never. I mean, it's not surprising to me, but I think to some people it would be surprising that people who end up being food writers, food historians, restaurateurs, or in management of large, you know, food corporations, to find out that they studied at CIA, and someone goes, I thought that's just where you went to learn how to cook. And
absolutely,
as you
right
just
now
described, right, indeed, that it's well-rounded, and that's so important. But back to cooking, you do have restaurants at all of the culinary, well, at least I know of the Hyde Park. I don't know about the others.
All the campuses.
All campuses have restaurants. And is there, like so many other culinary schools, is there student participation in these restaurants, and is that a part of their training?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's integrated into, I believe the CIA created that. We were the first school to have a restaurant that was part of the education.
Mm-hmm.
That's now called the Bocuse Restaurant. It's quite different. It was originally called the Escoffier Restaurant.
Right.
And legions of our alumni went through that. But we opened that when we opened this campus in 1972, and so I think some schools have followed suit, but we run these restaurants as professional operations full-time. You know, there's a GATT rated very highly, and people come from, you know, all over the region to go to the restaurants. Here in Hyde Park, we have the Bocuse restaurant, named after our friend and, you know, the legendary chef Paul Bocuse. He was here. We opened it on his birthday, and he was here for the opening, which was a thrill for everybody. We have the American Bounty, which has evolved over the years, but that, you know, was the original project that brought me back to my alma mater in the early 80s. We have the Caterina de' Medici, which is obviously an Italian restaurant. And we have the Apple Pie Bakery Cafe, which is a fast casual cafe that is run by our baking and pastry majors. And we generally have a pop-up concept, so we can keep things fresh and experimental. And currently the pop-up is, which is in a beautiful, great facility, it's called Pangea. And it's a plant-forward concept. So it's not completely vegetarian, but it's mostly plant for, you know, vegetables and grains and so on in the dishes, with you know, maybe in some a little bit of meat and protein, and that's been extremely popular.
Excellent. Such, I mean, it's just a wealth of of happenings around the world now, we can say, right, with these. And you, I have to say, you've been credited with spearheading so many of these changes. And I thank you, because I think it's a tremendous benefit to the world of food and to the education of those in the culinary and other fields. And also, I thank you for spending so much time telling us all about the history and background of the CIA. It's just, you know, amazing to me how much, you know, how much goes on there, more than meets the eye, for sure. So,
right.
Thank you so much. Well, and thank you for spending your time.
I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed your show.
Terrific. Thank you. All right. And thanks for listening. You've been listening to, of course, A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio. Please join us again.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.